I mentioned on the thumb drive there's some resources. These are the ones that are specific to this part of the talk. 5 steps to writing a powerful letter, how to recognize unfair reporting, because that's often what we're doing is we're sending out an action alert saying there was something in the paper that was unfair in some form. Making use of online comments. I'm only going to briefly mention something about that later, but it's something to think about. Top 10 letter writing tips and examples of letters to the editor. They're all specific to this part of the talk. So the first thing is to keep your eyes open. And I have Camera's 30-year thing on here. That some of these slides are directly from Camera. And if you don't know them, please go to their website, camera.org. There is a host of information. There's a huge amount of information. They've been dealing with this for 30 years longer. Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting in America. It's on the resource on your thumb drive, camera.org. And they have, you know, if you see somebody's name and you don't know what if they've done something before, just put in the search the name and they'll come up with all kinds of things that they've responded to by Gideon Levy, who's coming in, for example, the Haaretz journalist, the first Lannan speaker. And again, of course, we know his orientation. So the first thing you want to do is look at headlines. These are often misleading, okay, and we'll see some in a minute. You want to look at photographs. And again, those of you who remember either the Lebanese War of 2006 or the Gaza Wars, often these photographs were doctored, they were repeated. So the one from 2009 and 2014 may have been the same. Don't quote me on these dates. Yeah, often they have to be withdrawn or they're doctored because the only folks who take the pictures may be partisaned against Israel there are all kinds of other reasons for that. Keep an eye on the op-eds. It's not unusual. The op-ed may have nothing to do with Israel, but there's some gratuitous comment thrown in. And we see this all the time with Bill Stewart here in our own New Mexican. Nothing to do with Israel, but there's some negative thing. I heard the Reverend Wright speak at, I go to the Society for Jewish Ethics conferences irregularly. I used to go regularly. And it's always in conjunction with the Society for Christian Ethics, Society for Muslim Ethics. And it was in Chicago a couple of years after Obama was elected, and they invited the Reverend Wright to speak. Didn't make any sense. He's not an ethicist. He doesn't know anything about the sort of academic field of ethics. And he said, at the beginning, I don't know why I was asked to speak here because I don't know anything about ethics. And he must have said that 5 times during his presentation. But 5 times, and I counted them, 5 times, he made some gratuitous statement about Israel that had absolutely nothing to do with what he was talking about, to the point where we in the Society for Jewish Ethics went to the Society for Christian Ethics and protested and were given some space in their journal and at their next meeting to talk about why these things weren't correct. So you have to keep your eye on the op-eds, and that's sometimes the spoken op-eds, not just the written ones. You have to know how to analyze the articles. We'll talk a little bit about that briefly, okay? And then I mentioned the fraudulent photos. Here's an example. I've got several here. This was a piece supposedly of Lebanon, and all of this gray stuff was photoshopped in. And when they finally found out about it, when the protest came from Camera specifically, and Honest Reporting does this kind of work in Israel also, they had to withdraw all of the photos that this fellow, his name was Adnan Hajj, he had put out. He was the only one sort of who had access to take a lot of these pictures, and they had all been doctored. Okay, and they still are going around on the internet. Okay, so you want to keep an eye out for these kinds of things. Here's an example. This little girl appeared in about 5 photos, all in different contexts. She was killed 5 different times. These were doctored photos. Doctored in the sense that they were staged in this case. Okay, so the photo itself wasn't doctored. It was taken as is. But there's a very good... pardon? No, she's a little kid who was asked to, you know, can we pick you up, and played like you're dead. And she did that here and in an ambulance, and she was not dead. She was there's another picture of her in an ambulance, another picture. So these things happen all the time in the West Bank. I don't know if you remember what in theory started the second part, partially involved with the second intifada, of this 12-year-old kid who got killed with his he was with his father behind a barrier, and supposedly the Israeli army was shooting at them. Turned out the Israeli army hadn't been shooting at them. It took a while. But the French television station, I think it was Channel 2 or whatever, had actually staged this to happen. Okay, and so you could see, once you got the whole picture, not just what the camera was on, you could see people waiting in the wings. The ambulance was waiting in the wings. You know, they said, action. And the ambulance rushes up, and they carry these people off. Or, you know, this kid was actually killed, but it turned out not by Israelis. But in a lot of these other circumstances, nothing's happened. There's been nothing that's going on. Okay.
Probably at the same time, we have to say that you say nothing's happening. Nothing's happening specifically there. But people are being killed. There might.
I'm not saying anything about legitimate photographs. I'm not saying anything about the case where there's actually combat going on. I'm saying that keep your eye out to analyze the photographs, to analyze the headlines, to analyze the op-eds, to be sure they're legitimate, because we know that lots of these things coming out of these conflicts are not legitimate. That's the only thing I'm saying. Again, I mean, definitely there's conflict, definitely there's death. I'm not making light of those at all. I agree with you.
If you're computerly challenged, and you see a photograph, and you look at it, and you go like, well, on the face of it, see it in this way, and extra round it, how do you find that is a shot or a photograph? If you have the photo on, I don't know, from something, or you see it in paper, where is it that we go to say, camera, this is a picture that, this is what we've got. Is it an authentic picture?
Yeah, so... So it's a good question. It's not always obvious initially. Often what happens is it comes out after the story. And so you can get on, for example, camera's email list, and they'll send you emails when these things happen. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's not always clear. I mean, I'm not saying it's easy all the time to figure this out, but view some of these things with a skeptical eye, is what I would say. And not cynical eye, a skeptical eye, okay? Just to say, is this legitimate? Is there anything wrong here? Almost all of the foreign reporting, if not all the foreign reporting in New Mexican newspapers are from the AP or Reuters or others. Now, you would hope that they would have editors who would verify these things. But we know from... what was the fellow's name who was an AP reporter? Maddie somebody, I think he spoke. Maddie Friedman, thank you. He worked for the AP in Israel, and he has come out and said, the editors want nothing to do with verifying some of these things because it's too dangerous. But sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. But usually it comes out. Sometimes it's not for several months later. But that's a time when you can write to the newspaper to say, you remember this photo, it turns out it was false. You may not want to do that, and the reason you might want to write or not write is different than just finding an altered or fraudulent photo. Here's not altered or fraudulent. This is just clearly not the case. You'll often see photos or children's clothes in rubble. But what's interesting is, and this is just one example of many I could pull up, what's interesting is that they're not dirty, they're not buried, they're right on top, and they're organized in some way. You know, this clearly was not a photo that was taken that was left there in the rubble because of the bombing. And in fact, later it was determined, you know, clearly not so. But it's provocative. It says, oh my goodness, this person died. Look how beautiful they were. Look how, you know, they were just like this before, as we're just like that when we have our portraits taken in some way often, right? But it's not the actual situation that occurred. And I'll show you an even better one. What does this show you? This was accompanied by an article saying that Israelis were imprisoning Palestinian children. Do you know where this was taken? At the gate to a stadium. Somebody said a baseball game. The kids were getting ready to go into the stadium, okay, and they were on the other side of the gate. And the photographer, and they even had some of them, some of their, I think it was soccer, I'm not sure, one of their soccer, you know, partisan banners. And the photographer asked him to put it down. And he took a picture head on. And it didn't look that great. So he moved to the side, and he asked the kids to stick their arms through. I mean, this has been documented, okay? And then this accompanied an article about Israelis imprisoning children. Right, well, if you were imprisoned, you wouldn't look happy, right? So, yeah. So, what is the purpose of a letter to the editor? Right. It usually does. Yeah, but that's the whole point, is you can't trust them anymore. The reason I say you can't trust it is that they have clearly published some of these kinds of photographs. Reuters, AP, even the New York Times, okay, which, you know, God forbid, the New York Times, that's the Bible, right? Especially if you're from New York, right? So just to keep a skeptical eye and to ask yourself, is that realistic? Now, you know, many of them are, probably most of them are. But if you remember how, say, especially in conflict, but not even in conflict, you can't get into to the Gaza Strip and take photographs and come out and make and provide photographs to the rest of the world that show Gaza is good. You have to show something negative about Gaza, negative in the sense of, you know, they're poor, they're impoverished, there's rubble, there's, you know, especially around a war, because then those correspondents or journalists aren't allowed back in, right? Or if they do go back in and they happen to be Gazans, they may not live very long. So it's just something to keep in mind. It's not saying every picture. It's not saying every commentary. I mean, there is, as Ed points out, there is some truth to some of these things. And that's, as Shia or Suki said, there's some truth in most lies. And that would be the same with photographs many times, especially related to stories. Right? Okay, so why might you write a letter to the editor? Right, so bias or inaccuracies, and we did not arrange this in advance that you would say that first, right?
No.
Okay. Jeff. I'm sorry? An alternative point of view, yes. What else? That'll come up later in the list. I'm just... Well, let's look at, just in terms of biases and inaccuracies, they can be through media reporting or editorials, through opinion pieces, the Bill Stewart thing that Barbara mentioned, through op-eds, and through other letters to the editor, right? But an alternative view. There you go. We did arrange this. No, we didn't, actually. Yeah, I mean, you might want to say something even positive about Israel, right? Joy.
Well,
and that's the fourth purpose of Middle East Watch, by the way, is for people to feel like there are others who are behind them here, as opposed to sort of dangling in the wind. You might want to add information. And here's an example. When they had an article on the ReWalk, the exoskeleton type of device that was manufactured in Israel that helps paraplegics walk, right? They didn't mention in the newspaper, in the printed version, that it was made in Israel. So we put out an alert saying, send them a note. It was in the online version, but for some reason it got edited out of the printed version. And there was an article, there was a letter or two of our members who then wrote a letter, who then wrote in and said, oh, isn't it great what Israel does, right? And so part of what we're trying to do besides counter negative stuff is to encourage a more positive environment. And it may take years for this to happen, but you start somewhere, right? Once a month. Once a month, an op-ed every 3 months. Yeah. So we're not going to change their policy in this organization. What we can do is say, how can we best respond and write the best letters? That's the purpose of this segment. So then we could add information and sometimes even praise the media when they get it right. I mean, I think that's a better way. So we start to develop a rapport with them saying, hey, isn't this nice, right? And it also helps us when we call them to say, can we come in and talk about something? Because they know we'll be on both sides. You know, they do something wrong, we'll let them know. But they do something right, and we'll praise them as well. That's right. And sometimes we'll recommend you don't have to write for publication. Just say, this is not for publication, but I just wanted to express my appreciation. Exactly. Well, let's be clear. What does it mean that something is biased? Because sometimes we... Just because it's not our viewpoint doesn't mean it's biased, per se, right? And I think Suki and Chaya were getting at that a little bit in their discussion as well. Well, leading in a direction, but that doesn't necessarily make it biased, right? Where the argument is made that clearly ignores, say, the facts or key facts, you know? Okay, so here are some examples. So factual errors, as Steve pointed out. A lack of balance where balance is appropriate, okay? If somebody tells you that the earth is flat, you don't necessarily have to call them and ask them for their view on somebody saying the earth is round, because we know that the facts won't support the earth is flat. And this is one of the problems often, is that they'll make it look like a balanced article where the balance is nonsense, shall we say. Where there is an omission of important facts. So there may be factual errors, right? But there also may be omitting facts that are quite relevant to the argument, okay? If double standards, which was spoken about, Shia discussed earlier, you know, if there's a double standard, that's a bias. Now, you know, we talked about Zionism and racism. That, one could argue, is really a discussion of Jews equal discrimination, right? What does it mean to discriminate? What does it mean to be a Jew? All of those kinds of things, right? Well, sometimes these kinds of double standards come in where they're saying Jews shouldn't, but it's okay for everyone. Or the implication, without saying anything, is it's okay for everybody else. And, you know, if you have these discussions with folks in this town who are particularly anti-Israel, they'll say, you know, in essence, they want Israel to be the United States. They say that, you know, why should there be an established religion in Israel? Well, I mean, there's not, in a sense. I mean, if you're Jewish and you have religious things that need to go on, it's done through your religious authorities, not through the state, in that sense. We can get into the politics of that as well. It's a different issue, right? Okay. And then, if there's editorializing in a news story. Now, this happens much more than we sometimes think. And a perfect example was this Thursday or Friday. Okay, I'm not making a comment about whether I agree or disagree with what was said here, but I'll get to it in a minute. First, we're going to ask, what does it mean to have lack of balance? I'll give you an example of the editorializing in a minute. So, again, lack of balance doesn't require that all sides be given equal time, right? First of all, they should be credible sides, right? And this, and the amount of time devoted to them will have to do with what the story is. So while we may always want an Israeli spokesman or the viewpoint that's pro-Israel, sometimes the story isn't necessarily related to either the politics of Israel or a dispute in the politics. Sometimes it's related to something else, to culture, to arts, or whatever, and we don't necessarily need to have balance. If they're talking about, you know, a Palestinian artist, we don't have to have an Israeli artist at the same time. Okay, but if they talk about how Palestinian artists are oppressed and how they use a more generic term like Israeli Arab artists are oppressed, that's a different issue. Okay, that's something where we may want to have either an official comment or a sociologist comment on this or somebody who studied this, an academic who studied it, to say, you know what, the Arab Israelis don't get funding for art any more than the Jewish Israelis do on a proportionate basis. Don't take that as fact. I'm just using that as an example. So lack of balance is when you focus only on one side's point of view where it's appropriate to have the other point of view, okay? Where the preponderance of space and time given is to present a single viewpoint, again, where it's appropriate to have more than one viewpoint, okay? Where proponents of opposing points of view are given equal weight, even though one may be quoted directly and the other assumed. And we see this often where there's a Palestinian quoted, okay, and then official Israeli policy is stated as a statement by the journalist, not a request for an official Israeli response by either the government or whatever appropriate body would be doing that. Okay, so are both quoted directly, or is one side summarized and paraphrased while the other is directly talked about or asked or expressed? So here's an example. Here's an example of a reporting bias or imbalance. Okay, rockets follow Israeli airstrikes. A warplane blows up a minivan carrying senior Hamas militants in the Gaza Strip. Palestinians respond in kind. So what would you say about that statement? On the surface, it may not look bad, right? Okay, well, one thing is clear. The warplane blows up something. We get a certain image in our minds, right? Something gets blown up. Even if it's only from watching 24 on TV, you know, or whatever it may be, right? Whereas the Palestinians respond. Now, if you say something to me and I respond, you know, I mean, there's a whole different visual image of those between being blown up and responding, right? There's bias there, we would argue, okay? What else might you see? Right, David and Goliath. Well, that's right. So Israelis, are the Israelis striking civilians purposefully, or are they striking Hamas targets? Well, it's clear they blew up a Hamas. Yeah, all right, so here's another issue we'll get to in a minute, right? They blew up a minivan with senior Hamas militants, right? So the Hamas rockets are indiscriminately being sent over towards civilian populations, whereas here you have the airstrikes purposefully hitting the militants. So here's the other issue, right? What would you say? As opposed to terrorists, exactly. So you could also ask, all right, did Hamas target military targets or civilians? And the Hamas are militants, not terrorists. And we see this commonly, right? The terrorists are called militants by AP policy or New York Times policy, right? Even though they not only are they terrorists, but Hamas has been determined to be a terrorist organization by the U.S., by the EU, right? So, okay. You haven't seen the whole article. The problem is most people don't go to A5 afterwards, right? Right. So you get your initial impression from the headline or the blurb as opposed to otherwise. And this is something that we sometimes see in the New Mexican where the headline or the blurb isn't accurate at all. Okay, omissions. So we're missing important facts and context. So somebody talked about a settlement freeze. Well, there was a 10-month settlement freeze, right? But often that's not stated, right? When a boss says, I need a settlement freeze. Well, he got a settlement freeze, and he started talking at the 9th month, and didn't go very far, right? Previous offers to statehood. Egypt controls a border with Gaza. Why is it always Israel's fault that all aid doesn't get in, right? Egypt has closed down that border even tighter than Israel has, and more aid now gets in through Israel than gets in through Egypt, or the tunnels even in some cases. Thousands of rockets and missiles from Gaza, often not stated, right? Why does Israel take an action? Well, it's a defensive action in that respect. The Palestinian media incites hatred of Jews, and there are many, many more examples, some of which were discussed earlier, some of which you can think of yourselves. And how about double standards? Where one group is singled out for more criticism, you all talked about that earlier, right? Here's some examples. Gender-segregated buses in Israel are condemned, but state-sanctioned discrimination against women in Arab countries is ignored. Or even in the Palestinian territories, is ignored, as an example. Different terms are used to describe the same phenomenon. We talked about militants and terrorists. Perpetrators of atrocities against Americans are called terrorists, and against Israelis are called militants. I mean, look what just happened in New York City, right? My sister lives 2 blocks from there, right? They walk by that spot all the time, immediately called a terrorist, and charged with using a weapon of mass destruction, which is, I think, somewhat interesting also. One could argue is a pressure cooker in that. I wonder if we're going to have people licensed to buy pressure cookers going forward. Speaking of editorializing, that was an editorial. Okay. So, statements should be properly attributed, not the personal opinion of the reporter, if it's a journalist reporting on an event. If it's an editorial, obviously that's different. Loaded emotional terms and buzzwords, for example, some of the ones we've talked about. Colonialism, this is a favorite one. When Richard Falk was here, he used it all the time when he spoke for Lenin. You know, we think about colonialism today and we think negatively about it. Apartheid, the wall as opposed to the security fence, ethnic cleansing, genocide, terms that are thrown about all the time and not usually well defined, but they do have these emotional rings to them that are part of it. So let's look at the New Mexican from 2 days ago. Israeli leader invites Abbas to the Knesset in UN speech. Now, you don't see it here. I just showed the first part in the New Mexican, and this is an AP press. But it says, so this is a report of what Netanyahu said at the UN. I don't care if you like Netanyahu, you don't like him. We're just looking at the words now, right? I'm ready to negotiate all final status, but one thing I will never negotiate is the right to a one and only Jewish state. Then it continues, right, Netanyahu said. Now, there are no quotes, but it says, Netanyahu rejects a settlement freeze, rejects the 67 borders as basis for talks, and rejects any division of Jerusalem. Well, he didn't say that. He said none of that in his talk. If you go back and actually read the talk, I went back online, I pulled up the talk, he didn't say that. But this is an article about his UN talk. What did he actually say? He said something we might agree with. It's not about the settlements. It never was, okay? The conflict raged for decades before there was a single settlement, and when we uprooted all 21 settlements in Gaza and withdrew from every last inch, we didn't get peace. We got thousands of rockets fired at us. For the Palestinians, the real settlements thereafter are Haifa, Jaffa, Yafo, and Tel Aviv, right? And here's the key. He says, Now, mind you, the issue of settlements is a real one, and it can and must be resolved in final status negotiation. He didn't reject a freeze. There's nothing about a freeze in settlements in what he said at the UN, right? So it's the reporter or his editor who was editorializing here, right? Not what he actually said at the UN. It was an AP article that the New Mexican included. So the fact that they get all their foreign stuff from the AP or from Reuters or elsewhere doesn't mean we can't hold them accountable for it, right? Maybe they'll go to the JTA instead, right? The Jewish Telegraphic Press instead. Okay, just the facts, please. You know, choose the main point. All right, so we're now talking about how you can write a letter to the editor. And this is quick. It's simple. First of all, don't overthink it. You read something, you have a reaction to it. Write down your reaction, right? Write down your reaction. That doesn't mean that's what you're going to send in. But you can literally write a letter to the editor in 5 to 10 minutes. Don't let the notion of it hold you back, okay? It really takes almost no time, and I'll show you some letters where literally they were written within 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, okay? So you choose the main point that disturbs you the most. It's not all over the place. Take one point, right? We get troubled and we run out of space because you have 150 words in the New Mexican, although a lot of letters end up being longer, but target the 150 words so you have a better chance of being published, okay? And if you choose 3 or 4 points, you'll never get your point across. It's too much to do. You don't have to say everything that you want to say, okay? Just take one point, okay? Include the heading, the writer's name, and the main point you're refuting or that you want to make if it's a positive point, okay? So here's an example. In George Smith's op-ed on January 15th, entitled "Israeli Policies Hurt Palestinians," the writer incorrectly claims that Israel practices apartheid. Your viewpoint is clear, okay? You're telling what you're addressing, and it's very clear. Now, sometimes if there are multiple letters to the same on the same issue, this part of it may be taken out by the editor because it's stated in the first letter. Okay, so that'll give the date and the article name. But that doesn't matter. If you make your first sentence enough where they can cut it out easily, that's fine. Now, the next piece that Camera calls this is good things come in small packages, right? So be very concise. This is the hardest part of doing it. And in fact, there's a whole nother presentation of going from initial thoughts on how you can cut down and edit your own. Often, the best way to edit what you're writing is to give it to somebody else, because you're invested in what you've already written, and you find it hard to figure out how to cut words out. All right, it's part of what we do in Middle East Watch. Sometimes people will send us a letter or an op-ed and say, can you help me, you know, from this draft to rewrite it? I can only get it down to 350 words. I've got to cut 200 words out, right? Stay focused. Again, when you start drifting to wanting to make another point and another point and another point, you don't have to make all the points. You can't make all the points. You can't even do it in an op-ed. There's not enough space, right? Stifle your emotions. I mean, we do see lots of emotions in letters to the editor and op-eds in the New Mexican. Whether they're effective, I'm not sure, but I would doubt it when people start with a rage of some sort. So if you're going to write something and you're in a rage about it, write it all down, put it in a drawer. Come back to it the next day or the following day, or hand it to your spouse or significant other or friend and say, what do you think about this? Don't send it right off. This is a problem with online comments. People just throw stuff there. And if you read some of them, I mean, you think, you know, these people didn't even go to high school, didn't even go, you know, you think, how can they have such ridiculous arguments that they're making, right? Not just because the facts are missing, but just the way they make the argument. And frankly, we see some of that in letters to the editor in the New Mexican, right? Okay. The New Mexican itself. And one central point is plenty. Now here, the central point is this charge about apartheid against Israel is false. Now the rest of this is discussion about why it's all support, thank you, of this statement, right? Arab citizens can vote, freedom of speech and religion, Arabs serve in the Knesset, Supreme Court, have access to the best medical centers in the world, all right? Apartheid, whereas, what is apartheid? In this letter to the editor, it is a system of racial segregation where one racial group does not have the same political, legal, and economic rights as others, but that's against the law in Israel. You've made your point, you've said what it is you're arguing against. Let's be clear what we're arguing against. There we go, right? And it's not a lot of words. That's it. You're done. But you want to wrap it up, right? There's one last point. So you've made your first point, which is, this is what I'm saying, apartheid is nonsense. The second point, this is what apartheid is, and this is why it doesn't apply in Israel. And the third point is to reiterate, okay, maybe a little bit twist here. Israel's Arab neighbors practice religious and gender apartheid. They practice apartheid, right? So we're talking about double standards earlier, right? Without any public condemnation implies a double standard. Only by addressing concerns where apartheid is actually practiced can the lives of the Arab people improve. Right? Now, you can argue with whether that's the most effective closing. You could say, clearly Israel is not an apartheid state. It's against the law and all those other things that I just said. You can close with different things, okay? But that's the way to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, get on them. Don't let them get away with it. I think it's really wrong.
Yeah, it's a good point. Well, and the other thing is if they dramatically change it and it's to where they actually change the point you're making, then let us know as well, and we can go and talk to them and... You know, we're slowly developing rapport with them. It doesn't mean we... And they often won't change anything. They won't admit that they've made a mistake. But next time, this is a mantra that we use. We're in a marathon. We're not in a sprint. First of all, some of your letters won't even get published. Don't be discouraged, okay? Because in this paper, you can get more published. But if you were in New York or you were in larger cities, you get fewer published. And in those places, you might have to submit 10 to get one published. Here, you might have to submit 2 or 3 sometimes to get one published. Okay, but keep at it. Don't be discouraged. Writing this kind of a letter, if you already know the facts in your mind, can take 10 minutes. So, all right, you're all done. Wasn't so hard, was it? All right, you know, because we're running out of time, I'm going to stop some of these other examples. I will give you a couple of examples of effective letters. This is long, so I'm not going to do the whole thing. But it was Suki wrote it with her colleagues. What I want to do is just show you how it goes in the next... This says who we are, right? So it's important sometimes to establish who you are, especially if you're involved with a larger organization, because all of a sudden they realize that you're speaking for more than yourself, even though you may not be. And certainly don't misrepresent yourself. If you misrepresent yourself and the paper finds out, they'll probably not print another thing from you, assuming they keep a database in the first place, okay? I said stifle your emotions, but you can say if something is egregious. And here we use, Suki used the term shocked and dismayed, okay, expresses virulent anti-Semitism, hate and bigotry in the context of Israel. So that's the key focus of her letter, okay, some feelings and interpretive facts. And then political protest is protected by the First Amendment, so she's making clear that we're not saying people don't have a right to think this way, or to even write this stuff, and even hate speech can be done. Many of us confuse what's illegal in Europe with what's illegal here. Hate speech is not illegal here if it doesn't take you toward some kind of an action that could be destructive. And those details Suki and Shaya can talk about much better than I can from a legal perspective, okay? But we certainly can call it out and condemn it, and we can certainly ask the paper to do something about it, right, and not perpetuate it. So there's sort of the call to action, call out and condemn bigotry, okay? The letter holds all Jewish people responsible for alleged crimes done in Jewish name. These are facts and argument. Okay, so the first paragraph laid everything out. This is facts and argument. And then the conclusion, there can be legitimate criticism of Israel. Hate speech against Jews of any sort or other groups is not permissible from our view, or is dangerous. Okay, and this undermines peace. Oh, very well written letter. Yeah. Now, that letter probably was longer than the 150 words. I didn't actually count the words. That was for the reporter. Yeah, the reporter is 200. Yeah. Now, here's an interesting letter. You'll have to pardon at the end. Go to Word, and it'll do an automatic count for you, and however they do that. So here's an article about Cyber Oasis Rises in Israel's Desert, and I'll tell you the backstory in a second. It's so refreshing to read something positive about the many wonderful things Israel does in the world. It's a great example of how Israel's efforts help the world. Israel offers innovation and humanitarian aid far beyond any other country, often being first in line, the most organized, most giving, when tragedy and needs arise throughout the world. Thank you. All right? Now, I'm a little vested in this because I said to my wife when we saw this article, go write a letter. She said, I can't. Just go write it. And so that was by her, okay? Now, here's a letter just to tell you that a lot can be said in very few words. I don't care if you were Bernie Sanders partisan or not. That's irrelevant here. Look at what the comments are that are being stated, right? Many of you remember he went to meet with the Pope, but he didn't actually have a meeting with the Pope, so he eventually met him, and they had a handshake, and it was reported, right? So while having his en passant handshake with Pope Francis, perhaps Mr. Sanders might have noted that, and he had just released his tax returns, okay? Might have noted that he and his wife's own efforts at fixing inequality, his big campaign issue, in 2014 was a 4% charitable contribution deduction on an income that places them in the top 5% of U.S. income tax filers. I won't tell you who wrote that. Yeah, so it was me, but in any event. But you can see you can get a lot in just a few words if you really concentrate them. Well, they had said something. There had been an editorial in the Wall Street Journal a few days before. By the time it got published, it was, several days later, about Bernie Sanders' inequality statements, right? So I was responding to that, and that was in the first line, but they actually stripped that out because the letter before was responding to that as well, a much longer letter responding to that, and then they just threw mine in underneath it so they didn't have to state what it was toward. So I'm going to hand this out now. I'm going to ask you each individually to write a letter to the editor, okay? It should take you about 5 minutes to read the article. There are two articles here, or two items. Ignore the last page, which we'll get, if we have time, we'll get to in the political advocacy component. But if you need paper, we have plenty of paper. Take any point in here. It doesn't matter what you take. Take any point, okay, and here, let me, okay, this is, we will not grade you, okay. You might want to publish, although this is from an article in June, so the topicality is gone a little bit. Okay, do this all by yourself. Take a few minutes to read the article. Say there's one point here that I want to respond to, and write a quick letter. All right, who wants to share their letter? Nice, short, concise. Reggie? Great. Again, short, concise. Well done. So you make 2 points there, right? Yeah, well done. Great. Anybody else? Jeff? Nice. Great. Anybody else? Okay, so you see, and that took less than 10, maybe 15 minutes, both to read the article and to write the letters. So next time you get a blog posting from us that asks you to take an action, there are no excuses anymore, right? Unless you're giving birth, I guess, and I don't think that would most of us that doesn't apply to anymore.
Send it earlier in the day.
Send it earlier. Okay, so I want to ask you to help me make a decision now. Thank you. Keep these. Think about them. And next time you see something like the Netanyahu article, or it's not too late to write about the Netanyahu article, and you can find it on New Mexican online, saying why did the reporter editorialize Netanyahu didn't say that he rejects these things. So there are two more topics that I have, and I think we can only cover one. It is either how to write an op-ed, or it's how to do political advocacy with elected officials. Which would you prefer? Op-ed, pardon? Advocacy, op-ed, advocacy, advocacy. Okay, I'm sorry. Well, we wanted to leave the last 15 for other comments and questions. If we want to violate 15, we can go to 10 at that point. Okay, but still, there's not enough time to really cover both adequately. All right, so you want to do political advocacy? Let me okay, so just to let you know, I come at this from having been doing political advocacy for about 40 years. I've been a member of AIPAC. My first policy conference was in 1978. There were 200 people there. The last one was this past March where there were 18,000 people. We've seen a lot of growth in the organization. I'm still on their national council. I've been on their executive committee. And for the most part, our politicians are really trying to do the best they can. Believe it or not. I'm sorry. All right. Sorry. But a couple of things to remember. They're people, right? They're people. They have the same biases and the same imbalanced information or lack of information as everybody else. They make decisions the same way. Even though we want people to be rational, we can't claim that we're even rational in the way we make decisions, and we have high expectations of others, right? And since the mid-80s, I've been speaking about physician bias in the way decision-making has occurred. You don't want to hear that because you go in and see your doc and you want to know you're getting only what you need. But the fact is there's biases. Everybody has biases. Everybody has ways that they think of things. And if you've ever studied behavioral economics or political persuasive speaking techniques or sociology or anything else, they're biases. Okay, so... And by bias, in this case, I'm not talking about things like discrimination. I'm talking about just the heuristics and the biases that we live by all the time. Great book by Kahneman, a nice Jewish guy who won the Nobel Prize for Economics, though he was a psychologist, because he did lots of work in sort of, he and Amos Tversky were the founders of behavioral economics, both half Israeli, half American, as they did their work. Kahneman, K-A-H-N-E-M-A, one N or two, I can't remember. Thinking Fast and Slow was his popular book that, yes, came out about 3-4 years ago. All right, well, to be an effective political advocate, here's some things you ought to do. First, you want to get to know your elected official. You can't contact them once for one issue and expect they're going to listen to you, okay? They just have too much going on. If you ever go down to Washington and you see how their offices are run, they have meetings every 15 minutes, either with the congressman or with their staff, The staff are as important as the congressperson is, right? So even if you get a meeting here or in D.C. with Ben Ray Lujan or Michelle Lujan Grisham or Steve Pierce, if the meeting isn't actually with the congressperson, the meeting with the staff person is as important. Because the staff people, especially in D.C., where they're issue-related, they are specialists. Ben Ray Lujan's specialist in foreign policy is Scott Stockwell, for example. Okay, he's relatively new. But they both know more about foreign policy than Ben Ray. And that's not a slight on Ben Ray. He's a bright guy who's learned a lot in his 8 years so far in Congress, and he's become part of the leadership, and he's a good guy, and he has voted on our issues 99% of the time, okay? And so you can't really fault him, okay? I mean, there are ways you may want to otherwise, but he's a good guy, but you have to get to know him, all right? If you can, get the congressperson's cell phone number or direct email address so that you can send your letters directly to that person. But if you can't, and it's probable that you can't, okay, make sure you get the staff member's information at the front of a meeting. And if you can position yourself this way, and it takes time and effort, try to become the go-to person on an issue. It doesn't have to be the whole Middle East. It can be settlements. It can be internal minority affairs in Israel. It can be something that you have interest in that they know they want to call you about if something comes up in the Congress. Okay, it doesn't mean they will call you, all right? But sometimes they will. And it's more useful when they start calling you, you know you have created that relationship. Okay, and always be factual. It doesn't mean you can't state how you feel about things as well, but make sure you have the facts to back it up. And if you walk in and are just overly emotional about things, it doesn't go very far usually, okay? Unless you're already hitting on a key point that person is already biased toward, and then you're reinforcing their bias in some way, right? But when Michelle Lujan Grisham went to Israel and had meetings, because when AIPAC sends through their education affiliate, because AIPAC itself doesn't do it, sends freshman congresspersons to Israel, they don't just meet with Israeli leadership, they meet with Palestinian leadership on purpose, because the Palestinian leadership always shoot themselves in the foot, you know? And when Michelle went, she said one of the freshman congressmen almost got into a fist fight with the Palestinian leader who they were meeting with, because the Palestinian was blaming everything on the U.S. and Israel, right? And you know, they meet with the Israelis, and the Israelis say, we want peace, we're willing to do lots of things for peace, we need a partner for peace, whatever it may be, but they clearly want peace, okay? And the Palestinians have a whole different statement and narrative when they're met with, as an example. And if you don't know something, don't make it up, say you don't know it, and that you'll try to find out about it, and then make sure you get back to them. If you can't get an answer, fine. You can get back to them and say, I haven't been able to figure this out yet, but do it in a timely way, or get back to them with the actual answer. Now, there are lots of ways to communicate. Obviously, letter writing. Letters themselves aren't as good anymore as faxes or emails, and the reason is they quarantine the letters ever since anthrax, right, after 9/11. So it takes an extra week often, or 2 weeks, that between the time a physical letter is received and it actually gets to the office. So emails and faxes or phone calls or going onto their website and submitting something is better, frankly. Phone calls can be local or in D.C. Yep. Sure. Well, writing a letter, sometimes you won't hear back either. Or sometimes what they do is they wait until an issue is settled, and then they write a generic letter to everybody who wrote something to them. So, and that can be months later, because something may not go for a vote, for example, for months later. And when it's real generic language, they've usually voted against what you said. And if it's real specific language, it's usually because they voted what the way they've asked you to. Calling is fine. When you call, you should be very precise and concise and simply say, I'm calling to support X, or asking the congressman or the legislator. And when we're talking about elected officials here, we're not just talking federal. Well, that's where most of my experience is, but state as well, and even local, right? You don't like parking meters or the price of parking? These kinds of techniques work just as well for that kind of thing. Okay. And then, of course, visits. And the thing about visits is it really shows your commitment more, right? If you take the time to set up an appointment, even if it's not, it ends up not being with the congressperson or the elected official, but with their staff, okay, it shows that you care. And if you go to D.C., even more so. You know, don't when you walk in, don't say, well, I was here visiting my son, and so I thought I'd drop by. Say, I came to D.C. to talk to you about, right? I mean, you might soften that a little if that really isn't true. You want to be factual, you want to be truthful, right? But, you know, you can do it the right way. Now, when writing, just as we talked about, keep it simple. State why you're writing and who you are. And I mentioned the who you are, as I mentioned before, because you may be representing, or you can say, I'm a member of ADL, or I'm a member of Santa Fe Middle East Watch. You may not be representing ADL, only Suki and Shia can do that, for example, but you can. They think immediately, oh my goodness, there are 1,000 members of ADL in New Mexico. And so some, you know, or there are 100 members of Santa Fe Middle East Watch in Santa Fe alone. You know, they start to think, all right, there are others who think this way, and I need to take this more seriously. As I mentioned, provide factual information, avoid emotional language. Keep it short, so keep it simple and short, right? And close with a specific ask. This term ask, you'll even, if you're sitting with a legislator or you're sitting with their staff, they'll say, so what's your ask? It means, why are you here exactly? When you're writing a letter, it could be in your subject. Please support H.R. 2437. Okay, and at the end, therefore I urge the congressperson, the representative, or whoever it may be, or Michelle, or Ben Ray, if you know them personally, to vote yes for, or to co-sign something, or to co-sponsor a piece of legislation. These are all important things that show their commitment. And then even if they co-sponsor, they're likely to vote for it later, you know you already have their commitment on it, okay? So sometimes bills get dramatically changed with the same number through amendments, and they may not want to vote for it for some reason. Often, not always, but sometimes they'll get back to you before they even make their vote to say, you know, I co-sponsored this originally. It got changed so much by the opposition that I can't support it anymore, but if we can get it back. And then sometimes a movement is made to try and move it to get rid of some of those amendments that were done. So keep it simple. Wear only one hat. If you go in or if you're writing, don't say, I'm interested in healthcare and I'm interested in Israel. When you're going in today, say, I have my AIPAC hat on. I used to do health policy lobbying also. So when I'd go in, I'd meet with different staff people because they had different expertises. Right, but if I met with a congressperson or senator, I said, I have my AIPAC hat on, or I have my Middle East Watch hat on, or I have my American College of Preventive Medicine hat on, whatever it may have been. Okay, I have my Jewish hat on. Don't schmooze. Schmoozing is nice. It's fun. We all learned it. We love it. But you're not there to schmooze. You're there for business. I've been in meetings where there are two or three people where somebody walks in who knows the congressperson more personally, and they spend half the time schmoozing, and you don't have time to get your point across. So even if you have to interrupt them, do that, okay? Ask for only one thing with each correspondence. Sometimes you can ask for two, okay? And when I write, at an AIPAC conference, we'll go in, and we'll have three lobbying points. One is usually to support foreign aid to Israel. The second is usually related to the peace process somehow. And in the last couple of years, it's been related to Iran, or it might be related, in this case, it was to oppose, when I was in a couple of weeks ago, oppose one-sided UN resolutions. Okay, to urge the president to veto those. Okay. So when you get back to them, though, or if you're writing something and you haven't actually met with them or done anything, try and keep it to one point. All right. If you sit with them for 15 minutes or half an hour, you can discuss more than one point. But try to keep it to one point. Okay. Now, when you're writing, state why. Be specific. I'm here to ask you to support anti-BDS legislation, H.R. 2234. Okay. Who you are, if possible. As possible, personalize it, as I mentioned. As a constituent in Santa Fe, so they know you vote, right? But you may be voting, you may be writing to Michelle Lujan Grisham and you live here. You're not a constituent, you don't vote, but you make your voice heard and you make the Jewish community's voice heard or the pro-Israel community's voice heard, okay? I'm particularly interested in promoting. Now, you might want to link something that's good for the congressperson or the elected official, if they're in the state or in the administration of the state, to Israel, right? So you can say the economic well-being of New Mexico through our number two foreign trading partner, Israel. Most people don't know that Israel is the number two trading partner of New Mexico, believe it or not, okay? As a member of Santa, number one is Mexico. Yeah. As a member of, you could say, Santa Fe Middle East Watch, I care about New Mexico trade. These are just some examples, right? Or you can personalize it. This is, I made this up, but my sister lives in Ramat HaNegev and works by manufacturing drip irrigation that's used in New Mexico. Her job will be at risk if the BDSers have their way. Right, you might have defined BDS earlier in the letter, as will the 75 Palestinians who work with her. Right, so you showed some balance here, right? And you've also shown why it's important for New Mexico not to be a BDS-oriented group, all right? So anyhow, connect to the larger group I've already mentioned. And factual information, international trade supports about 72,000 jobs in New Mexico. This is drilling down on the jobs issue. Israel's the number two trading partner of New Mexico, $1 billion in 2014, second only to Mexico, which was $1.6 billion, okay, $1.7 billion. The U.S. and Israel share deep values, right? This doesn't have a lot of traction with people who are virulently anti-Israel. They don't care. But it does have traction to congressmen and legislators who believe in these values. I mean, they're dedicating their lives to these values. So it's not just what America is, but it's who they are, right, and pluralism. I mentioned avoid emotional language, keep it reasoned and relaxed. If needed, hit controversial points with a reasoned argument and response. It's okay to make it clear that you feel strongly about something, okay? But don't use threats. We saw this, there was a meeting that Ben Ray Lujan had about the Iran deal where some people came in and said, if you vote for this, I'm going to do everything I can to make sure you don't get reelected. That is not an effective argument. It does not... It does not really ingratiate you to the person. Most of us don't have that kind of power anyhow, right? Even as hard as we want to work on it, right? So don't, it's even so. And especially in writing. And by the way, some of that can be illegal, right? You never want to link a vote to a contribution, you know? You never want to link a vote to a defeat, you know? I mean, you want to ask for something and be respectful. And hope that their first response will be sure. That's the way I'm going to go. Okay. Here's an example too, where you can say something like they say this is about BDS, and this comes right from the BDSmovement.net colonialism and apartheid website. What they say: Israel is occupying and colonizing Palestinian land, discriminating against Palestinian citizens, etc. What they mean is Israel cannot be a Jewish homeland, right? So sometimes you can clarify the alternative language. You don't usually want to use the alternative language or the opposition's language. You don't want to give any credibility to their wording, all right? But if it's out there already, sometimes you can, okay? You want to be real careful about doing that, but it's just something to think about. I mentioned keep it short and focused. Staffers are going to read this. Your congressperson isn't first. Staffers don't want to read more than a page. They are inundated day in and day out with phone calls and letters and faxes and emails. I mean, you can be sitting in a meeting and they're doing their email where they're still listening to you, okay? Purportedly still listening to you. And as I mentioned, keep it to 15 minutes in a meeting, okay? And practice. I don't know how often people think, oh, I don't have to practice, you know, or it's silly to practice, or this is artificial to practice. If you've ever given a really important public speech, have you ever practiced at home and you practice at home? Why is it when you're going in to do something as important as lobbying for the state of Israel, for a deeply held conviction that you have, and you don't want to practice? We actually do that at APEC. We have caucuses before we go in, and we follow some of the things you'll see soon. The ask is specific, clear, and measurable. I want you to vote for X, or please vote for X, or please co-sign something. In the Congress, it's very easy to see if they've done it or they haven't. It's not always easy to see how they're thinking about it, right? And sometimes it can take months to get an answer, as we've discovered, right? You know, measurable, so you might say something like, please vote for H.R. 3240, the anti-BDS legislation initiative. It's going to be marked up for this Thursday. Or please co-sign. It closes by close of business on Friday. In other words, for signatures, for co-signing. And that's the case with the letter that you have here on the last page. I was in Washington a couple weeks ago. I went in and visited our three congresspeople and our two senators. And this is for the two senators, because our congresspeople had already signed on or not signed on to the Granger-Lowy letter. And two of our congresspeople signed on to that, Lujan and Lujan Grisham. Okay. Pierce is very pro-Israel, but he's extreme. I mean, you won't find a more pro-Israel congressman than Pierce. He didn't happen to sign on to the Lowy Granger letter for the reason I'm mentioning. But this letter, originally by Gillibrand and Rounds, we got 88 senatorial signatures on. So if anybody says that Israel still isn't a bipartisan issue in the Congress, and that's certainly in APAC, we work hard to make sure it's a bipartisan issue, not a single-sided issue. Granted, the Iran deal ended up being mostly a single-sided issue, but that wasn't because of the work we did. That was because of the way it got, you know, put together. And I don't want to go into all the pros and cons of that right now. We can have a discussion about that another time. But our two senators signed on to this letter. So one of the things I was going to ask you to practice today, but I think we're running out of time, is go home and write a letter to Tom Udall and to Martin Heinrich and thank them for signing on to the letter. It's as important to thank them when they do positive things as it is to be upset with them when they don't. Okay. Now, So we're going to do this practice. Just Gillibrand Rounds letter. Okay? You can say, thank you for signing on to the Gillibrand Rounds letter. I can actually... So here's the actual letter, and there's where their signatures were on that list of 88. It was hard to find them because they don't do them alphabetically or by state. They just have them based upon who signed first and who signed next. But, okay. So here's some key points. Thank you for co-signing the letter. It's very straightforward. It's all you have to say. Put it in an email. Put it in the subject line. Right? This is an important reminder to the President and his UN diplomats that one-sided resolutions of the Security Council are detrimental to peace. Okay. Easy, simple sentence. Has two points. Right? One-sided, they shouldn't be, and they hurt peace, they don't help peace. Right? Appreciate your ongoing support for a strong U.S.-Israel relationship. And that's really what it's all about. Again, at APEC, we don't go in to lobby for only what Israel wants. We go into lobby to make sure that it's on both parties' benefit in one way or another. Okay. And that's it. As I mentioned, in the House, 394 House members signed a similar letter, Lowy Granger. It's on your thumb drive. You can read it if you want, including Lujan and Lujan Grisham. It's never too late to thank them. Send them an email. You know, you can write one email and then cut and paste. Just make sure you change all the names sometimes. Occasionally I've sent something to Ben Ray, and I'll say, please ask Michelle to do so. And I look up, oh my gosh, did I do that? Okay. So that's all time we have for now. There's a whole nother section on how do you actually organize a meeting with elected officials. We can do that another time, hopefully. We can get back together. Well, ADL would have to speak for themselves. From Middle East Watch's perspective, you are welcome if you want to. It's much preferable. We don't try to, and we haven't, you know, a lot of letters that we've had submitted to the paper, none of them have had our name on them. We want individuals, we want to help individuals write as best they can. You're always welcome to send me, you know, you say, I'm trying to write X, here's a draft. Don't just send me saying, I want to write something, what should I write? Because I'm not going to write your first draft for you. I used to teach at universities, and you know, I wouldn't write the students' first draft either, but I would critique their first draft, and so. But you're welcome to be in touch if you really want to say something. Now, usually when we put out an action alert, we'll say, "Here's some key points you can make." We don't tell you exactly how to write the letter. We'd rather it come in your own language with your own voice, okay, and your own style. And so it's better not to cut and paste necessarily what we send to you. It's better if you look at it and then incorporate it into your own voice. Because if they see, as I mentioned earlier, if they see sort of cut and paste where everything looks the same, they discount those. And you'll get those from organizations. Both you may be part of AARP, for example, and they'll send out sometimes a request that you contact your congressmen or senators. Basically, a language is identical that they get. Now, it doesn't mean they don't take it seriously, but they don't take them as seriously as if they're all individualized, and they don't look like they've been their form letters, basically. Comments, questions? Okay, so just before we leave. Rabbi wants to blow the shofar, since you're supposed to hear it every day of Elul prior to Rosh Hashanah. Thank you again, Shia, for coming out from New York. Yeah. Great. And if you want to learn more, again, don't fail to go to the ADL website or the Santa Fe Middle East Watch website. And we have lots of resources. Look at your thumb drive.